Thanks, Rob. Yeah, thanks for the invitation. And, I just have to thank Liv also for the invitation and the opportunity to be here, which is my first time in Canada. Well, first time in Toronto and now first time in CETA, in Perimeter, which is real fun. And we had the first snow here. We saw the first snow today. And it is Bring Your Kids to Work Day. So that's why you see this unknown person, this unknown to be scientists in the audience, maybe asking complicated questions, which I will not answer.
We have two.
Yeah, sorry, we have two, indeed. Bring Your Kid to Work Day too. But I don't think he had free from school. At least didn't need it for this particular case.
She has a lot to say usually about talks.
Well, she's welcome to ask any questions. So I wanted to start with a very Canadian painter. And this is a $5,000 painting by Brian Scott, a Toronto, or actually a Vancouver artist who paints sort of chaotic systems, in my perspective. And this is a very low chaotic fractal number painting. And that also reflects the price. The lower, the higher your fractal dimension of your painting, the higher the price becomes. So this is something like a 1.0 fractal dimension, 1.2 maybe. So it goes for about $5,000. I'll give you an example of a sort of more expensive thing. So you can wonder, why do we like fractal paintings? If the fractal dimension goes up, the price goes up. And it's not a linear increase in dimension. So we like fractal dimensions, we like fractals, we look at trees, we look in the forest, we feel at home, we look at the snow of crystals, and I look at the embodied problem. And the embodied problem is very chaotic and very fractal too. And I limit myself to Newtonian dynamics, and the reason is that, for me, that's complicated enough. And I can understand the differential equations. I think that the two Bring Your Kid to School Day kids can write down the equations and solve them already. At least one of them I know, and there is a richness in it. And I would like to share a few of these richnesses, and I would like to share one of the things that surprised me a little bit, and that is the fractality of things. And if you think of fractality, then in the 80s, everything was a fractal. Everything was broccoli, clouds, trees, the beach, the coastline. And then people started to do calculations in computers getting bigger, software getting better, and then it died out. People stopped being interested in fractal dimensions or in chaotic systems because they say, you can't calculate it, it's all too complicated. The mathematics gave up, the mathematicians, they gave up very quickly in these terms because they couldn't solve it. The computer scientists gave up, the astronomers gave up, the physicists gave up. So there was very little progress in sort of fractal or in chaotic system studies. And I'll tell you how I got interested in this and why I think it's interesting, but I'm still not sure it's really interesting scientifically. Maybe I'm studying the shape of clouds, which would not be very interesting, or maybe I'm studying the weather, and that would be very interesting, right? So the difficulty in studying chaos is, are you studying clouds, structures of clouds, or are you studying the weather? And one is interesting and the other, I don't know. So Newton is my my big hero, one of my big heroes. And the other one has a little quote, which I put there on top. It's also one of my heroes. Ignorance is strength, and that is very particularly the case for my science. I ignore everything. The universe is sort of infinite. It's not sort of infinite, sorry. The universe is infinite, and there's only one law, and that's the law of Newton, right? So that's the simple thing I'm talking about. And actually, I'm talking about point masses. So I'm talking not even about black holes. Black holes are big for me, right? But these are really point masses. And Newton, no Einstein. Now, I know this is wrong, right? So this is a sort of an academic interest thing. Another academic interest thing for me is this multi-scale, multi-physics part of the universe. So I'll just to show you that I'm not completely ignorant of the rest of the universe, I'll show you this image where you have a baby picture of the universe in terms of scales, right? This is the galaxy, and here you see if you zoom in on certain parts of the galaxy that the universe is a multi-scale, multi-physics environment where the scales range, well, the interesting part is this, the scales range over 24 orders of magnitude. So if you go from the smallest scales to the largest scales, you have about 24 orders of magnitude of difference in scale, at least in my, for an astrophysicist. If you're a biologist, it's even more. And it's 7 orders of magnitude in terms of time scales. Now, I do these things with computers. As a sort of computational astrophysicist, I use these machines. And they are, by software and by hardware, limited to 16 decimal places. And actually, the last decimal place I can't even trust. So maybe 15 decimal places. So how do you solve 24 orders of magnitude when you only have a machine that can solve up to 15 orders of magnitude? And maybe even less if you do more calculations. So how do you do that? That's one of the things that worries me. And I know there are solutions to it, but are they good or are they not good? So this is the last really physical slide. And let's start with sort of a human perspective. If you look at a collection of people, like here in the room, for example, there is sort of a common thing that binds us together. It's not gravity, but it's sort of a social aspect. And I'm not going to talk about sociology, except maybe for this one video, where you see sort of a non-chaotic, homogeneous, isotropic movement in space, right? And there is a little sound by it. So what you see here is sort of driven perturbation. Right? So there are two modes in this. So there's the audible mode and there is a physical mode. And if you see the vastness of this, in the Netherlands we can't do this, right? This is the whole Dutch population more of you have here. So this you could compare with something like the galaxy. If you look at the galaxy, it's a collection of stars, about 100 billion stars. It's a little bit more than we had Koreans in the previous picture. But if you have the whole galaxy, it's a communal motion. You see the spiral structure, you see the structure of the galaxy, and it doesn't change on our time scale. Well, at the same time, we know that Newton's equations of motion are intrinsically chaotic, right? If you have multi-body systems. So this system looks very regular, like the previous picture, like the previous movie. It looks very regular. Everything moves in coercion. And in the galaxy, you see that too. But if you go to a three-body problem, and the Chinese know everything about this by now, if you go to the three-body problem, you know you have intrinsic chaoticity. Now, how can you claim that the whole galaxy is regular if the three-body problem is irregular? Right? So the intrinsic microscopic physics of the galaxy is chaotic, so the whole galaxy must be chaotic. Or is that not be the case? Now, let me first look at the concept of three-body systems. So three-body systems are chaotic, I said, but this is not necessarily true. So there are cases where your three-body problem is actually not chaotic. And how do you solve that? How do you address the chaoticity, or how do you address the non-chaoticity of small and large n-body systems? And I'll do that by computer. And as you said, Rob, we built these things our own. That's why I have to show off my latest little toy. This is what we call LGM2, little green machine. And this is one of my postdocs, and this was it's the first time I touched the machine, actually, right? But I generally don't say this, right? But this was for the newspaper article, and they said, well, Leiden has the fastest computer of the planet, which is not true. But of course, these are newspaper things. It's four pizza boxes. It's about a 4 teraflop machine. Of course, it's based on GPUs, and we built it in collaboration with IBM, and I'm pulling at a few of the cables, hoping I'm not destroying anything. But it works fantastically. So the fun thing with computers is, the speed of the computer doubles every 2 years, or at least it used to do that, right? Telescope observing machinery doubles every 80 years. So the difference is that an astronomer is born with instrumentation as a grad student, and at the end of his career, still using the same instrumentation. Maybe one next generation, right? If he's lucky and old enough. A computer scientist has seen, during their PhD, they already see two generations of computers, right? And then you become a postdoc, and by the time from a master's student to a full professor, you have seen 10 generations of hardware. Imagine, right? I mean, this is mind-boggling. The fact that computers have become a billion times faster since the time I did my PhD. So the way I write software is different now, or should be different now than it did 10 years ago. Which it isn't, but, you know. Okay, well, there's a whole other story behind this, but let me show you the story of the three-body problem. The three-body problem, you think, okay, I have gravity, Newtonian gravity, and I have three-body problems that do something chaotic, but they not necessarily do something chaotic. And it was discovered by Montgomery in the 90s, that you can have regular three-body problems. And this is one of them. This is actually found by a group of Chinese researchers using the biggest computer on the planet, Tianhen 2. Actually, it means galaxy number 2. And this is a regular three-body solution. So there are three bodies, and it's pure Newton. They're point masses, and they move in coercion, and they repeat themselves. And you can do it with three bodies. You can do it with four bodies. Can you do this with 100 billion bodies? Can you have a 100 billion body system like a galaxy that moves? And at some point, all the stars are at exactly the same position again as they were sometime in the past. And in what sort of universe do you need to do this?
What is the tail there?
Yeah, this is the time, right? So this is just the past. This is the orbit of the object. So the big bullets you should see as the current moment in time. And I plotted 10 points or 9 points behind them to show sort of the movement of the... Otherwise, you have all these points just popping around. It's not so interesting. So this would be more interesting to watch. And if you make the tails longer, you will see that it is repetitive. And you have the same encounters over and over again every time. So this will go on forever in my universe, right? This is not chaotic. You can integrate this. You can do numerically. I can do it on my telephone, right? Very easily. And you don't need a high precision. I can do that in 2 decimal places accurately, and it will still show the same pattern. So I don't need a high precision, and I don't need accuracy, high accuracy, to do this. But in a chaotic systems, I do. So if you go to the expensive paintings and you want to understand those, then you need high precision and high accuracy. And already in 64, Miller explained that errors in your calculations of the n-body systems, that's the thing we're talking about here, right? Newton, grow exponentially. That is what we call chaos. So chaos is a very fancy word. It's fantastically chosen. But the only thing it means is that if I make a very small error or a very small displacement in my initial conditions, I end up somewhere completely different than I had intended to, or than when I did not make that error. And I can make that error in 2 places. I can make it in the initial conditions, and I can make it while going along. If I make an error in my calculation, I do the same thing as making chaos. So I'm driving chaos by round-off error and by the precision of my calculation. Precision and accuracy, right? These are the 2 things. So who knows what this painting goes for? Or who knows the fractal dimension of this painting? No? Now, the fractal dimension is 1.6, which is a very interesting number. Sorry?
Jackson Pollock.
Yes, Pollock, yes. Jackson Pollock is his last painting, 1954. I thought 15, but it could by now well be 100 million. Yeah, something like, you know, order tens of millions of dollars. And the fractal dimension 1.6 is very interesting. If you go outside here and you look at the trees, it's about 1.6, right? If you look at the snow, it's about 1.6. So why do we like 1.6 as fractal dimension? I have no idea. I don't know. I like it too, but it's for another reason. So how do you address chaos in your Newtonian system? So there are 2 problems in chaos. And I said it before. There is precision and there is accuracy. And there is a difference between the 2. So let me think of an archery, right? I'm not an archery, but I know that Canada has a famous number of archers. World champion in 2016. And precision accuracy. So if I'm precise, I shoot all my arrows like Robin Hood, right? They all penetrate each other. They all come at the same point. So all my arrows will be very accurately positioned in the where I put the first arrow. But it may not be the bullseye. It may be off from the bullseye because I may have a systematic offset. Then I'm very precise, but I'm not very accurate, right? Because I always miss the bullseye. But it also can be very accurate without being precise. That means that I shoot my arrow somewhere, you know, at that blackboard, and they end up anywhere on that wall. None of them is in the bullseye. But the average is precisely in the bullseye. Then I'm very accurate, but I'm not very precise. So 2 things are very important in doing these simulations, well, in doing these paintings too, I guess. Is being precise and being accurate. And how can you solve that? How can you treat a computer in such a way or abuse the computer in such a way that you make your calculation precise and you make your calculations accurate? So where does it go wrong? So it goes wrong where I make round-off errors. because I have a limited number of precision in my computer, 16 decimal places. And it goes wrong because I do an integration. I do a discretization of time. And in my discretization, I discretize my differential equation in time steps. And every time I take a time step, I make a tiny, eeny, meeny little error. And I make my time step smaller, and my error becomes smaller. But at some point, I can't make my time step smaller anymore because I have the limited precision of my computer. Right? So my precision is limited by the hardware, and the accuracy is limited by the software. Okay? Now we can solve that because, you know, the computer is a general machine, right? It's just we use it stupidly, but it is a general machine. I can program it. I'm the boss. So you write a computer code, and we call it Brutus because it's brute force. And with Brutus, we solve both problems. And it started with Charda. Charda Buchholz was a grad student. Well, it was a master student. And I had this idea of writing Brutus. And I said to the master student, he was good in computing. I said, you know, you go away. You do your master thesis. You write me an embodied code that is arbitrarily precise and infinitely accurate. And he went away, and I forgot about it. And 3 months later, 4 months later, he knocks on my door. And suddenly I remember, Charda, yes, of course. You're going to tell that you have a problem. He says, yes, I have a problem. Okay, sit down. Then I remembered I gave him this problem 4 months ago. He probably going to tell me that, you know, he failed. He will go out of astronomy and et cetera. Maybe he finishes his master, maybe not. He says, yes, I wrote the code. And I was like, huh? He says, yes, I wrote the code, but it is so slow. I said, well, isn't that the whole purpose of this code? That it is slow, but you get the right answer, right? He said, yeah, I get the right answer, but it is so slow. I wanted to speed it up. I said, well, you can't speed it up, right? This is physics. I said, when do you start your PhD? He says, no, I'm quitting astronomy. I took a job in industry, and I think my whole astronomy career is a failure. I said, you quit your job right now. You are a grad student, and you'll continue in my team. Which he did. He's now a postdoc in Portugal, and we wrote a bunch of paper on this stuff. So how do we do it? You do it in two ways. You use a Burle-Stur integrator. You know the Burle-Stur integrator, right? Numerical recipes, page 324. You can just read it up. And you use the Burle-Stur integrator, and you calculate, you overload your operations to arbitrary precision. So you can now make your calculation arbitrary precise and arbitrary accurate by extending your mantissa of your computer and using an integrator which can take care of this. And with Brutus, we can now do this calculation. So this is the instrumentation. And yeah?
Did you figure out why it was so slow?
Let me give you an example. If I do a calculation in normal 16 decimal places, with a time step of 10 minus 4, which is a typical time step people use in these sort of embodied calculations, I can do a three-body integration in about a minute. Now I extend my number of decimal places to, let's say, 200,000. So I overload my multiplication operators, my divisions, my square root, to do not 16 decimal places, but 200,000 decimal places. You get the point?
Yeah, okay.
It's bad.
Okay. So it wasn't any slower than you were expecting, is the point.
No. It wasn't. No. That was pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
This is your famous Archer, and you see she's precise and accurate as long as you have three bullseyes, right? So she's independently precise and accurate. Let me show you how we do this calculation. So what we do, we take an initial realization, which we do to a limited number of precision. And then we do the calculation with Brutus. And we have two freedoms. We have the precision, and we have the accuracy. So let me start with precision. Precision is here coded. In the top left, we do a calculation. And you don't see anything because it's so wrong that you can't even display it. And what you see here is time. And on the vertical axis, you see the logarithm of delta. And delta is the phase space distance. In this case, it's not even phase space. It's just physical distance. But it is the phase space distance between the initial realization going to a certain place in time, integrated to a certain moment in time, and a slight deviation from your initial condition. So I have two calculations. One is my initial realization, let's say the basic initial conditions, and I have a slightly different initial conditions. And I calculate them both in time. They will deviate in time, And what I measure is the distance between these two points as a function of time. Right? So it's a distance between two calculations. And in this case, you see that I have upper left is the two numbers, minus 4 and 65, 56. 56 is the number of accurate bits I have in my computer. And the minus 4 is the logarithm of the time step. So the time step is 10 to the minus 4. And I have 56 precise digits in my bits in my calculation. And I start with 72. And you see the displacement is sort of a linear function or a power law in time. And then I reduce my precision from 672 to 80, 88, and to 96 in the top right. And between 96, I should use the hockey stick, right? I think in the Netherlands, we would take a soccer ball to do this. I throw up the soccer ball to there. So you see this is changing. This curve is changing here. It's changing when I increase the precision of my calculation. So that means I'm not converged to a final solution. If I extend my precision, I still get a different answer. Until I'm here, and I see that if I extend my precision even more, this curve is identical to this curve. So I have my calculation converged in terms of precision, right? But not in terms of accuracy. So now I improve the accuracy. From here, I can go to here, and I see that this curve is different than this curve, right? So I have converged in precision, but not in accuracy. And here you see that by this accuracy, actually, I have converged here at the same number of decimal places. That's good, right? Just the validation. So I have a different answer. Now I increase my accuracy again, and again I get a different result. And I check here to see if that's the same if I have the right precision still. And I do it again here. And here you see that I have converged to my solution. So this picture and this picture this picture does not change anymore. Actually, you see that it's still not completely converged. Don't tell anybody, right? So this is converged, and this is almost converged. I don't think this will change very much anymore. And the reason this is not finished, because this is still running, right? And this is how we get to what we call a converged solution or a definitive solution. So the difference between, so when we wrote a paper about this, we got into trouble in communication. He said something and I said, what do you mean? I said, well, I don't know, but let me explain it. So we had a problem in terminology. And therefore we had to invent this terminology. There's a dictionary in the paper. Converged solution is the solution you reach if you increase the precision or the accuracy, it doesn't change anymore, right? And the definitive solution is the best solution you think you can ever reach by numerical integration. If you have an infinite amount of computer time and an infinite number of decimal places, you will get a definitive solution. But of course, you don't get a true solution because I don't know how accurate nature is doing the calculations. Right? Okay.
Can I ask?
Yes.
I don't feel as convinced as you are that those last two are really the same.
These two.
No, the one above and the one in the bottom corner. So the bottom right and the one immediately above it.
These are not the same. No, I agree. Yeah, I agree. I'm not convinced either.
Completely different.
Yeah, they're different.
Where they first dip over. And also, if you look at the bottom two, they are more different than any of the pairs above them as well.
I agree. This is illustrative, right? This was a bit too much of a complicated problem to show you. But do you understand the concept?
I understand the concept, yeah.
Good. That's the important point.
I wouldn't say you've completely shown that if you continue to go down that it's going to not change anymore.
I'll show you. Not for this particular case because it's still running. But I'll show you for... This was a calculation actually of the solar system. And the problem is the solar system, it has so many bodies. So it's a bit harder than the three-body problem. So go back to the three-body problem, right? This is a nine-body problem. But the three-body problem. So the chaotism in the three-body problem, I would like to illustrate this a different movie. And this was a sumo bout I was at with Steve McMillan, a friend of mine and a colleague. And it was between Acesorio and Boruto. And they fight together. And there is a third man walking in this sumo bout, directing the two. That's the arbiter, right? So the arbiter is affecting the sumo wrestlers. So This is Accessorio. Sorry. Yeah, and this is Brutto. And I sorry, this is Brutto. Accessorio is fun because he always throws the salt on the ground, right? I mean, you know, right? You have seen this. You've been in Tokyo, right? So here's the arbiter, and they go into each other, and the arbiter is yelling. And then what happens? Boom. And so what you see is an ejection of one of the particles after a resonant interaction with the third body, right? The minor third body. So the minor third body can have a major influence on the interaction between the two big bodies. Now let me go to the more mathematical case, which is much more boring, I think, but it's scientifically much more interesting. This is two calculations exactly on top. So this is answering your question. This is two calculations where you start exactly on top of each other. And one calculation is with a normal integrator, and the other calculation is until we have a converged solution. And you see that after a crossing time, they deviate from each other. So one calculation is doing something different than the other. Right? Is this funny? Wow. After a crossing time, you have two completely different calculations. I think it's very interesting. So they're on top of each other, and now you start seeing that it's actually black and red together, right? But the most important thing is that one object is shot away in a completely different direction with a completely different velocity than actually what the converged solutions will tell you. So if I do these calculations, I know in a normal integrator I will get the wrong answer, because I don't have the luxury to make a converged solution for every three-body problem I do, and I definitely do not have the resolution to do it for an entire galaxy.
But you could be analyzing the error, and at some point you'd say, well, the error is getting too large, I don't trust anything beyond this, and the rest of the movie is crap.
So where is this error?
Well, you do the Richardson extrapolation and try to find out what is it that your solution is ultimately telling you should go to, and then it's going to be very different from what you're...
The error in the wrong solution is almost machine precision. Right? This is better than what people normally do. Normally people allow an error of 10 to the minus 8 or so, and this is an error of 10 to the minus 11. This is a really good calculation. But the error you need in order to resolve this interaction needs to be 10 to the minus 74, which is outrageous, right? So you would say that the error you make is good enough, but we don't know, right? We don't know. So if you do, for example, I know that one individual calculation gives me the wrong answer. The question now is, can I do a large ensemble of wrong calculations and get, on average, the right behavior? Right? Okay. Well, you can test that. You can test... I should talk about that now, maybe, but I'll get back to this. Okay? You change the order of my talk, but I will be resilient. Right? So one thing to solve this is say, hey, my calculation has to be time reversible. If I say I imply that my calculation must be time reversible and I force it to be time reversible, for example, by integer arithmetic, I can force my calculation to end up and start at the same result, calculate backwards, and get back your initial conditions. You can do that. So time reversibility is the ability to numerically go backwards and forwards in time. It basically means I control the error I make in my round-off and the error I make in any of the round-offs during my calculation, right? Is that your point? It's more or less your point, I think, right? You can do that. And we did it for this three-body problem I just showed. And this is the result. So this is this phase-space separation between two solutions. This is time. And we make an initial error of 10 to the minus 10. Small, but not ridiculously small. So the tenth decimal place, we make a very small perturbation in the system and run two cases, and they deviate from each other. And at t is 100, one particle shots away, as you saw in the movie, right? This big guy shooting out. We turn the velocities around, and we continue the calculation. If you turn the velocities around, Newton is time reversible. It should go back to the initial conditions. And what you see happening is your initial deviation from 10 to the minus 10, you have some wiggles, it goes up. Particle escapes, hockey stick. Looks like a hockey stick, right? hockey stick, escapes. We get bored because particle escapes. Turn the velocities around, calculate backwards, and we end up at exactly the same initial realization. So here you can demonstrate that if you have a converged solution, this is a converged solution, you get exactly the same, to a certain number of decimal places, the same initial realization where you started off with. Right? If you do any normal integration, you get, for example, the blue curve or the green curve, or whatever color this is. But now you can do it with this. And what do you need? You need 10 to the minus 36 and 136 Montesa for this three-body problem, right? So, okay, I will not play with nature. These colored curves are what we call reprehensible solutions. So a reprehensible solution is a solution to the embodied problem that does not give you the right answer. But you think maybe it's good enough, right? That's your energy error, right? You think it's good enough, but how do you know? Can you do an ensemble averaging and get the average right result, or can you not? So can a collection of reprehensible solutions give you a statistical ensemble average of a correct solution, of a converged solution, right? And we wrote a paper about this, and we called it Nahoch. So Nahoch is the concept, this is how you write it, Nahoch, the concept that an ensemble of random initial realizations in a whole range of parameter space will give you, on average, the right solution. So people who study the solar system do this. They take the solar system, and they change one of the planets, the position of one of the planets, do the calculation, do a whole large number of calculations. They do 100 calculations, and in 5 of those calculations, Mercury ends up in the sun. And then what they do, they say, okay, there is a 5% chance that Mercury will end up in the sun. Nature paper. I don't know if this is true, right? So this did calculation apply to Nahoch or not? If it did, then they're right. If you can say that this is a statistical measure of your ensemble average, yes, sure. But I don't know if that's the case, because nobody ever did the experiment. So when we tried to publish this, we had Nahoch in the paper, and we sent it to FGA Letters. Fred Rasio, he was the editor. He phoned me, he says, Nahoch, that's a strange word. Is that Dutch? I said, no, it's Klingon. He says, you can't believe, right, that I can put Klingon terms in my nice journal. I said, why not? I mean, if he would have taken a Latin term, he would have accepted it. Latin is a dead language. Klingon is, you know, it's alive, right? I know people who speak Klingon. So he didn't, you know, it ended up in a mathematical journal where it was accepted. Actually, the paper was accepted in FGA Letters, but without Nahoch. And then we wrote a second paper where we put in the term, and that was in the mathematical journal. Okay, let me give you an example of how we do the statistics, right? How do you do the statistics? So you can do a large number of calculations using Brutus and using whatever garden variety embody code. In this case, Hermite fourth order predictor corrector scheme, individual time steps, blah de blah, nice integrator. This is what the industry uses. Everybody uses Hermite for this sort of thing. We use Brutus. And what you see here is the phase of the binary at the moment that the star escapes. The one star escapes, we have a three-body problem. One star escapes. What is the phase of this binary at the moment that this third body escapes? And I just took this as random, we checked them all, they all look the same. So what you see here is that the phase can be between minus pi and pi. And of course, in Hermite, it can also be minus pi and pi. Plus or minus your energy error, right? And then you see a diagonal. And these are the cases where, you have an encounter and immediately escapes. So you don't need any precision to get the right answer. And that's the diagonal. That's the point that ends up in the same phase space for Brutus as the same phase space for the Hermite integrator. You basically don't have time to make an error. And the moment you have time to make an error, it is completely homogeneously distributed. Right? So any result I get with Hermite is definitely going to be wrong, right? It's like a clock that is always standing still, and therefore twice per 24 hours it gives me the right time, right? That's what I'm seeing here.
What exactly the space is?
The phase It is the angle, okay. Yeah. Strictly speaking, it is the angle at the moment the star escapes, that we determine that the star escapes at a certain point in time, and it's the angle between the direction of the escaper and the separation between the two stars. That's this phi. But you, I mean, you can measure many things, the velocity of the escaper, you know, you can, the time of the integration, you can do it. Whatever you do, you get a similar picture. So is this now Hoch? I think this is now Hoch, right? Because if I take the average of my Brutus calculations and I take the average of my Hermite calculation, they end up sort of at the same location, right? So to first order, Hermite complies to now Hoch. I don't make the people with the planetary dynamics pretty happy, right? It's not the same as saying it's a probability, but at least it's you know, it's getting into the right direction. Let's make it a little bit more interesting, right? Let's go to a 60-body system.
So just one question. Yeah. So both are kind of symplectic integrators, or
one? No, this one is not symplectic.
Okay.
And this one is anything you can dream of, right? Except GR. Yeah, Hermite's not simple. You can do this with symplectic integrator. You get the same junk.
You said if you average it, you get the right answer. But this variable is a phase. You can't average a phase without defining.
Yeah. Okay. So for the phase, you can't do it.
What's being shown here is that you get no information from knowing the answer from Hermite.
That's right.
So there's no average information that's correct. It's just you get no information.
Right.
I agree. If you plotted something like the escape velocity, that might not have been true.
That's right. So for the escape velocity, or for the binding energy of the binary, or for the eccentricity of the remaining binary, for example, it's you can do the averaging. But for the phase, it's the wrong example in that case, right? So you can do it for 16 bodies. So I can do the same thing what I did for 3 bodies before. I do it for 16 bodies. So this is, I did this for a Dutch talk. So this is 6 decimal places round off. And it's 16 particles. And after the white one, the red one starts. And this is 10 decimal places. And then you can do 12 decimal places, and 14, and 16, et cetera, et cetera. And every time you get a different answer. And the question is, where do these errors appear? Where do you start deviating from the converged solution to the apprehensive solution, right? And you can study that separately. I will not do that here. But I will go on to, I should have shown this earlier to demonstrate the exponential divergence, I realize now.
So it looked like it was starting to converge there between
pink and blue. It's, so some orbits start to converge earlier on, and then later on other orbits start to converge. Yeah, and actually this thing goes on to tomorrow. So you can have a look at it if you like after the talk. I'm very happy to show it. So this is just to show, same thing as the three-body system. Now you see how the delta, how this dispersion in time, and the phase-space distance in time grows in this case. Now I wanna change gear a little bit. So is this practical or not? Do we understand something better now than we did before? I think I still don't understand if you can do 100 simulations of the solar system with small perturbations and then say that there is a 5% chance that Mercury plunges into the sun. I don't understand this because we did the reverse calculation, for example, and then Mercury doesn't suddenly appear out of the sun, right? So that should happen too, but it doesn't. And that tells me, I think, that these embodied calculations are, I'll say it politely, apprehensive, right? And there are more conceptual problems with this. Let me show you a problem we found when we were discussing this. Chad and I were discussing this. And it came this a paper by a number of people. And it was about the comet Halley. Halley is a very interesting comet, right? It's the first comet discovered to repeat. And Halley found it. Well, it was already known for a long time. And here, this is a picture of it. You can make nice photographs. We can't, right? I mean, you know, the younger people here will see Halley, maybe, if you're lucky. But I probably don't. Halley has a funny orbit because it's retrograde. It's going against the orbit of the planets. And that makes it very interesting dynamically. So it is perturbed by basically everybody there. but at a relatively high velocity, because it goes in the wrong direction. Well, maybe it goes in the right direction, but it goes in the other direction. And therefore, it is perturbed. Everybody always says Halley is being perturbed by Jupiter most, because Jupiter is most massive. The encounters are fast. So Jupiter has the biggest influence on the orbit of Halley. And we know that the orbit of Halley is chaotic. It's funny, because when you think of Halley, how he found it, he did the calculation. He said 67 years. Every 67 years. Sorry, 76 years. This is a difficulty in Dutch. Sorry. I mean, the Dutch put the numbers, I think the Canadians put the numbers the wrong way around. So every 76 years, Halley returns. And he was spot on. But actually, he was not. Because if you do very accurately the calculation, you see that Halley is always a few days early or a few days late. And why is it early and late? It's because its orbit is chaotic. And it's chaotic because of internal effects. It's evaporating, right? And it's pulled around by the planets. Now, forget the evaporation. We just look at the effect of the planets. Just Newton, right? My Newtonian universe. So, I have to. I'll skip the definition of Ferrasius. I mean, I can. Let me say what Ferrasius means. Ferrasius limited that. The concept that the limited bounded variation of the initial condition, I have to read it because I don't know it by heart anymore, right? I wrote it up so too complicatedly. So this is that you can do the solar system integration of this 5%. So this is the, I'm getting chaotic. Let me go back to Halley and forget the Ferrasiousness. So if you look at this picture, this is the orbit of Halley. This is the semi-major axis of Halley. And this is the eccentricity of Halley. And you see the eccentricity of Halley is known, 967622. That is the unknown number. This is how accurate we know the position of Halley and the eccentricity and the orbital submajor, the axis of Halley at this moment in time. Same for the semi-major axis. We know the position of Halley of 1 meter accurate. Right? I think it's mind-boggling, right? I mean, if you listen to Gaia and gravitational wave mergers, it's not so impressive anymore. But this is very impressive. This is in the solar system, right? What they did here, these people, they did a calculation in a very high resolution. So at centimeters accurate, they started making little changes to the orbital elements of Halley. So they take a serialization of the solar system. They take the comet Halley at a certain point in time. And then they make centimeter deviations from in semi-major axis and eccentricity of the comet Halley and do the integration. And then they calculate what is the time scale on which my two solutions, so my one solution, Halley is Halley, and Halley is a copy of Halley with a little perturbation, deviate from each other. And the deviation is here color-coded, from red to blue. And blue is long Lyapunov time scale, so non-chaotic orbit. And red is very chaotic orbit. And what you see here is a sort of a patchy world where the comet Halley is either chaotic or it is not chaotic. But most of the time it's not so chaotic, but some spots are really hot. Really, really very chaotic. And I looked at it, and we read the paper, and they concluded that the chaoticity timescale, the typical Lyapunov timescale for the comet Halley, is 76 years. And I was like, come on, you know, why would it be the orbital period, right? And we looked at the picture, and we didn't understand anything of it. So we thought, why don't we take Brutus, and we redo the calculation, which is a bit expensive, but you can do it. And what you then see is what they're measuring here. Who can guess what they're measuring here? They're measuring the first round off they make in generating their initial conditions. That's what you measure here. So they measure the first round off in their initial conditions, and then they do the calculation. So if you do the calculation with Brutus, you get a very much smoother curve, and you get a time scale of about 3,000 years. So the Lyapunov timescale of Halley is about 3,000 years. And I can demonstrate that. This is the deviation, so the phase space distance between all the planets we had in this calculation. And well, there's a few planets, not all planets, but the inner planets, which are important here. And Halley. So this is Halley. You see Halley has a displacement of 10 to the minus 30 or something. And in time, it crawls up to something larger. And it takes about 1,000 years or a few thousand years to really start getting into its exponential part. So the Lyapunov timescale of Halley is not 76 years, but it's about 3,000 years. And you should be very careful if you apply these embodied codes with limited precision, so the apprehensive solution of your embodied codes, and try to say something of the Lyapunov of chaoticity, right? because you round off and your errors you make in the integrator, they kick in really hard. And the other thing that was a surprise to us is that it is not Jupiter actually perturbing Halley, but it is Venus. So Venus has a bigger perturbation on Halley than Jupiter, even though Jupiter is much more massive than Venus. Any idea why? So the
inclination of the orbit?
The orbit is inclined. It never gets anywhere close to Jupiter. And its pericenter distance is about at the distance of Venus. So actually, Venus gets much closer to Halley, or Halley gets much closer to Venus than it ever gets to Jupiter, even if you take the mass into account. Let me show you the movie, without sound, I'm afraid. So what you see here is the solar system, and we integrate this over many years. You see the time there. And you see that the apocenter of Halley, this is the big thingy there, how it sort of deviates, how it jumps around, right? And that is basically the chaotic orbit of the comet Halley. And this is not a planet, right? This is Pluto. Just a dwarf planet, you know, put it in for fun. For the miracle. If you give this talk in the United States, you know, the audience is immediately happy that Pluto's in. So this is the chaoticity of Halley, and it's about 3,000 years, and it's Venus perturbing the orbit. Now we have this convert solution for the solar, I just want to show you, you know, convert solution of the solar system. Simply because you can do it now, right? This takes, we bought a work, when we thought of doing this, we bought a workstation. We took a 4.2 gigahertz chip. We beefed it up to 4.8 gigahertz. put it in a corner, start to run, and a year later we came back, and this was the result. So this took a year, and you can't paralyze it, right? It's 9 bodies. It's Mantissa, you can't paralyze, because before you have to calculate the hundredth decimal place, you have to know the 99th decimal place, so it's not easy. You just have to be patient. And this is the dispersion, so the phase space distance between two calculations of the outermost planets and the sun. And now you can calculate the Lyapunov timescale of the solar system. The Lyapunov timescale of the solar system is 12 million years. I think 12 million years is awfully short, right? So what does it actually mean, this Lyapunov timescale in total? So it means that, okay, strictly speaking, it means that it is the timescale over which we have difficulty predicting where the object will be, right? But the solar system is bound, so the planets will be on their orbits around the sun. It's not that chaoticity means that Jupiter suddenly is on the place of Earth and Earth on the place of Uranus or something, right? I mean, that's not what chaos means. It means that the orbit of the Earth, the phase of the orbit of the Earth, which is not conserved in Newtonian as a Newtonian quantity, becomes unpredictable. So we don't know whether or not it's winter or summer anymore. So any calculation of the climate, which goes beyond 12 million years, they can't tell whether or not it was summer or winter anymore, because that's the Lyapunov timescale of the solar system, right? Earth doesn't change its orbit that much, right? Or not in an unpredictable way. And we can demonstrate that it is really exponential, right? By this curve. So the exponential is the solid curve, fits better than the power law. We thought actually, you know, when we did this, we hoped that everybody would be wrong and the solar system would not be chaotic at all, and it would be very regular and would be a power law behavior on the initial error. Regret that would be a Nature paper, right? I mean, this is you know, so everybody's right. The solar system is chaotic, and the time scale is about 12 million years. No surprises there, right? And now you can say, let's do the same study as what the people, these Mexicans did on the comet Halley, and see why does nobody agree on the Lyapunov timescale of the solar system? So the question you can ask is, why do the Europeans say it's 100 million years, and the Americans say it's, the United States people, I understand here, people from the United States say, the teams there, that it is shorter than that. So why do they disagree? They both use the same instrumentation. And the reason may be that also there, the phase space is very flocculent, that you can have different initial conditions and you get a very different answer. And it turns not to be the case. So the phase space is very regular. If you change the position of Earth or whatever planet, you get a very regular color grading in your initial to final, or your Lyapunov timescale, basically. So the solar system is chaotic, and the chaoticity timescale of the solar system is rather solid. It doesn't change very quickly. So let me just end with a few messages, right? So chaos is a very fancy term for nothing else than high sensitivity to initial conditions. You all know this, but we tend to forget when people talk about chaos, right? We think it's a sexy term, and then therefore we see all kinds of, you know, troubles on the way of physics. But really, there is nothing else to say than it is just exponential divergence. Now, Hoch is right, I think, so far we have tested. So a statistical ensemble of apprehensible solutions will give you a converged mean canonical ensemble solution. That doesn't mean that you can do statistics on your ensemble of solutions, because we don't know if the statistics applies. And the variation of the orbit Halley are driven by Venus and not by Jupiter on a timescale of about 3,000 years. And that is actually the thing I wanted to share with you. A little bit of chaos, a little bit of embody, and a bit of, I don't know, where to go here, right? What is the next step? Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, what is the next step?
Oh, sorry. I think there are several things to be done. And Charda was visiting me in Toronto a month ago. And we wanted to finish a few projects, but instead we made a whole list of things to do in what is the next step. And I think one of the next steps is further testing ferocity and further testing Nahoch. So the two different concepts that say whether or not it's statistics. Can you apply statistics to an apprehensive solution? And the other thing is, if I use different integrators and I do a statistical ensemble average using different integrators or different initial conditions, can I apply that to my converged solution? That's one of the things I think I would like to know. And I just would like to know out of astrophysical and natural consequence and curiosity. I think that's really the thing that needs to be done. And then we can say whether or not the people who do planetary dynamics and say Mercury falls into the sun is a 5% chance are right or wrong. I think it would be an interesting thing to do.
It's just a question about, well, every time you decide you want to simulate a system, do you have every time to redo the computation in order to find the converged solution? I mean, because how do you set the precision and the accuracy for you to say, oh, this is what we found with the converged solution?
Yeah, you have to do the whole nine yards.
Okay.
So you have to converge on precision and you have to converge on accuracy.
Okay.
Both. Otherwise, you don't have a converged solution.
Okay.
So you don't have to do the whole matrix. Of course, we do it a little bit smarter than this. But in explanation, it's clearer. So we have an idea. Once we know what the precision is we need, we sort of know what the accuracy is we should have. And you can make steps in it and et cetera. But you have to do it all.
And how do you know this converged solution exists?
We don't. So that is an interesting point. So the reason to do this Pythagorean problem, the three stars, the three-body chaotic system, which I showed, is because I read a book, actually I stole a book from Springer, at a conference where I booked this, and they had this three-body book, and I took it away and I put a little note on it. I stole it, not my name on it. And later I came back and they said, oh, you can have it, you can keep it. So yes, I did steal it, but they finally gave it to me. And it was a book by Valtonen and Seppo Mikkola, the two absolute godfathers in the field. And in the book there was this one sentence, and they say, there are certain initial conditions which by no way you can solve up to a converged solution using Newtonian dynamics by computer. And I think this is wrong. And this is one of the things we're exactly testing right now. So if you say future project, yes, we are testing the particular cases of which they think they are impossible to integrate numerically. And I have to say they are not easy, but we'll get there. No, sorry, I'm not the chair, right?
But what was the source of the error in concluding that the Lyapunov timescale for Halley's Comet could possibly be 76 years? What did they get wrong in making that conclusion?
The conclusion is right.
Okay.
But the way they got there is wrong. So their way of calculating it was an apprehensible solution of the solar system, including Halley. So it was wrong, right? They made round-off errors, which propagated into the system. And the initial error they made, initial round-off they made, at the 60 decimal place, crawled up on a timescale of 76 years to the first decimal place. And the reason actually, why is that 76 years, is rather easy. If you calculate the orbit of Halley, it's one orbit, how many steps does your integrator have to take? Every time you make this step, your error is going to increase and it grows exponentially. So you can demonstrate analytically that on a time scale of about 100 years, you lose 16 decimal places of accuracy. So they if they thought about this, they could have known, but they just took an embody code from the cupboard, run and said, hey, paper, right? Which is fine, it triggered us to do interesting other things. Yeah. Bad luck, I think it is, for them.
How much this topic is amenable to analytical approaches? Like, how much is like numerical experiments and how much can you say by, I don't know, like, it kind of mixes a lot of sources of error, like taking the initial condition as a random variable and precision and accuracy. So how do you analyze like the data that you get out of this?
So where do you want me to start?
We have seen a lot of like numerical results. Like how much can you say analytically about the system or like the way the time step evolved? So.
I don't know. I would love to talk to a number of theorists who can explain me from a theoretical perspective how I should look at this problem. Because I'm not equipped to do this from a theoretical perspective, but I'm very well equipped to do it from a numerical perspective. I think one of the things I'm struggling with is, apart from pure the theory of chaotic systems, is, for example, KM theory, right? I mean, if you apply KM theory to this problem, you can maybe explain one of the things that really intrigued me, and I'm happy to share it with you, but we are thinking about it very deeply. If you have ideas, by all means. So this is the Lyapunov timescale, basically, of this particular three-body problem, right? And what I do not understand is that it starts basically flat, and there is some wiggles. I think we understand the peaks and the wiggles. But I don't know understand why the system knows that it has to have this particular Lyapunov timescale. And then suddenly, this system decides to go on a different track. And then it memorizes that it has this particular different Lyapunov timescale. And then it does it again. I don't really understand this very well.
Isn't it just that you have a mode that is growing from much, much more values? It's growing all the time, but it has been obscured by this other one that was seeded at a larger value, and then it takes over.
This is a convert solution.
To the degree of accuracy and precision that you've been able to achieve, but I mean, maybe you have something that is much more
growing. No.
From the bottom up.
I can improve the Mantis, I can improve the precision and the accuracy of this calculation, and this figure will not change anymore. Right?
But you are having an initial perturbation between two orbits, right?
If I make a different perturbation, I just lift up the thing.
Yeah, but I think what Louise is saying is you have some perturbation and you project it on different modes and it has like a small overlap with the fastest growing mode, and maybe a larger projection on ones that have like a smaller.
If I make a different perturbation, you mean?
Yeah, you could find a different perturbation that would just grow immediately.
Maybe. But still, for some reason, the system memorizes its Lyapunov timescale, and then it thinks, maybe I should have a different Lyapunov timescale. And it changes its behavior. And I think if you change this perturbation, or you do something else, or you take a different system, you will get a different, similar behavior of changing Lyapunov timescale, but keeping the same Lyapunov timescale for a while. That's one of the things I would really like to understand. I don't know, who asked the question? You asked the question somewhere.
So how much of this is specific to Newtonian dynamics, as opposed to like, if you did similar analyses in GR,
you get very similar things in GR, but so at large distance, GR doesn't count anyway. And at very small scales, you get collisions. So what GR makes very special is that you can get particles which really hit each other, even if they're point particles. As long as they have mass, they can really hit into each other. So in GR, you get an extra solution, that is that two particles, or maybe all three particles, hit each other. But the rest is just as chaotic as a Newtonian case. I thought that the GR case would be less chaotic, and in principle it is, because collisions are sort of non-chaotic, right? I mean, it's ends. But the rest is just as chaotic as Newton.
Is this system according to Nachhorde, your hypothesis, you think?
Well, this is one system, and if you want to test Nachhorde on this, we should make many of these initial perturbations and see if statistically they get the same. We didn't do that, so there's an interesting suggestion to try.
So the question is more, that seems to be a big statement to say that on average the dispersion of your apprehensive solutions will yield the converged solution. That's what
yes,
you're saying.
Yes, that's a big statement.
So
yeah.
Do you have an underlying principle for understanding that, or is it just from observation of the solutions?
So there is an underlying principle that is used by the planetary dynamics people who say that the moment it becomes chaotic, you sort of fill up parameter space. The system becomes ergodic. And if it's ergodic, you can apply Nachhorde, basically. So that's their argument. And our argument is, we don't believe this. We would like to test it. And we did it with 10,000 calculations in one calculation, one numerical solution, and compared with a converged solution. And in the 10,000 cases, we think this is the right statement. So that gives us sort of an error bar on the statement.
Yeah.
But I'm still not convinced. So I'm right in 0.1% or so, 0.11% maybe. Yeah.
The fact that the statistical ensemble works, does it imply emergence of some collective degree of freedom or some approximate integrability, like even the behavior you see?
That is, for me, that's the suggestion here, right? So that there is another aspect of the system that predicts its long-term behavior. And I can tell you how we have been thinking about this. And what you see happening here is that the system changes behavior from a resonance dynamical system, so what we call a democratic resonance, to a hierarchical resonance. So in the first few orbits, it is all three stars are close together. And then when the sort of uplifting starts, you get an excursion of one of the objects. So you get a more hierarchical structure. But how the structure of the system translates into a Lyapunov timescale, I've no idea. But for me, it suggests that there is an underlying conserved quantity, which I don't understand. It's a good end for a talk, right? I don't understand this at all, right? You can go home back to Leiden, right? Yeah.
Right, well, there's a chance to ask more questions because we have snacks downstairs in the bistro. But for now, let's thank Sam again for supper.
Thanks.